with the tape cut. It has been incredibly complicated, Amy, sitting in the trial, listening to the testimony of these people. And we're going to go just in a minute to an update from that trial at the San Francisco Federal Courthouse. I just want to remind people that they're listening to Pacifica Radio's live national broadcast, Veterans Healthcare Special, The Crisis in Veterans Healthcare. And if you want to post a question or comment for us to read on the radio and join the conversation, you can do so at warcomeshome.org.
You can also send us an email at vets@warcomeshome.org.
Or vets@kpfa.org.
I want to welcome Joshua Coors, investigative reporter with The Nation magazine, who's attending the trial this week and standing by with Rose Kiptachi, KPFA reporter. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Today, the second day of the trial, more evidence is being presented. What's interesting about the case is that the Veterans Affairs Department first tried to dismiss it, and now more evidence was being presented. What's your take on this case?
The basic idea is that the VA is denying care to wounded soldiers. That's really not at issue by either side. The question is whether these veterans groups can mandate that they operate in a different way. The VA is saying, we're going to handle our business, and it's not your purview to meddle in the way in which we operate. These veterans organizations are saying, because the suicide rate is so high, because there have been these systemic failures for so long, it's time for a judge to step in and alter the system.
Joshua, in court yesterday, the VA argued that the veterans are a special interest and have no standing to sue.
That's right. And it's interesting, in the clip you just played with the VA spokesman talking about the burden on the VA to have to prove a service connection, I think a lot of veterans leaders like Paul Sullivan, the executive director of Veterans for Common Sense, who is spearheading this lawsuit, would say that burden is simply a fictional one created by the VA, that in a different system, perhaps one more amenable to the care of veterans, they wouldn't require that the soldiers provide proof that their wounds were caused by service connection. What happens in a lot of these cases I've seen is that soldiers come back, they're wounded, they need care immediately, but the burden to prove that their wounds came from war allow a gap of time in which they get rapidly worse. Aaron, as we talked yesterday, biology doesn't wait for bureaucracy. And a lot of times, the brains of these soldiers, having gone through a traumatic brain injury or a severe case of post-traumatic stress disorder, are so corrupted by the time it comes to receive care that they're too sick to really get fully better. A stronger system that Paul Sullivan is advocating is one in which the soldiers get care right away, and later, perhaps there'd be an audit system if some of these soldiers are scamming the system. But Amy, the idea that there's a mass scam going on by the soldiers to receive care when actually their wounds were pre-existing is really not something that is borne out by the cases themselves. It's certainly not something I've seen in the years I've been reporting on these veterans.
We're speaking with Joshua Coors, an investigative reporter with The Nation magazine. Joshua, you're following the case. The case is getting national attention with articles being written in some of the national magazines and newspapers. So clearly there's interest. Since such a small percentage of Americans are in the military or know someone in the military, why are Americans focused on the health care of veterans at this point?
Right now it's a crisis. As Aaron pointed out, we're having a massive backlog. And it's not only going to cost in financial terms, but it's also going to mean a generation of sick people. And we have 1.6 million soldiers who have served, 840,000 who are still serving. And as the RAND Corporation revealed a few days ago, we have 300,000 who have post-traumatic stress disorder and 320,000 who are coming back with traumatic brain injury. I think the public is only going to understand in the future precisely what that means. I think simply the condition of post-traumatic stress disorder is vastly misunderstood. And to understand it, one would only have to put themselves in their shoes. Imagine you came back from Iraq with a pounding headache so severe that vision would shut off in one eye, as was the case in one of the cases I looked at recently, or you would have nightmares so traumatic that you wouldn't want to go to sleep, so you would stop sleeping. How long would you let that panic and that headache run before you decided, you know, it's simply not worth it to continue, I'm going to kill myself? That's really the situation a lot of these soldiers coming back from Iraq are facing.
Joshua, we've posted on the website warcomeshome.org one of the memos that was presented in evidence in court yesterday from Dr. Ira Katz, the head of mental health for the VA, where he says in response to an internal agency argument, a thousand veterans attempt suicide at VA facilities every month, and why the shush? Why the fight against these veterans? Why the confrontation?
It's a fantastic question. I certainly was one of the members of the audience who gasped when I saw that email. Reminds me of what one of my sources said to me earlier when I was investigating these cases, that the government is doing everything they can to cover this up and just doing a lousy job of it. Certainly, if you were trying to keep quiet about an issue, you wouldn't write in an email to a fellow official, shh. That email was also subjected not to be shared with CBS News. Amy, as you know, CBS News reporter Armin Katan had done a devastating report about just how widespread suicide was in soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. This was information that the VA knew about, how it was even more widespread than CBS News knew. But that was information they were deliberately not going to share with the public.
And part of the reason that we're doing this Pacifica Radio special on veterans and health care, you can join us online at warcomeshome.org or send us an email at vets@kpfa.org. We're here with Joshua Coors from The Nation magazine talking about the case. And if you look at the warcomeshome.org blog, there is a comment that was just posted. I'll read it. Why do I feel like a freeloader when I go to the VA? I served my country for 6 years of my youth in Vietnam. I still have issues with my service. Why do I feel guilty? Joshua, this really brings up another issue, which is veterans feeling welcome and able to take advantage of services. Do all veterans have the right to have health care at the VA?
They do. But that kind of feeling of rejection is part of the adversarial system that we're seeing in reality from the VA and from the Army hospitals. It's not supposed to be an adversarial system. And in fact, one of the devastating issues to be raised in yesterday's hearing was that soldiers are not allowed a lawyer when going through this process. Amy, the jargon and legal mumbo-jumbo that was thrown back and forth in the courtroom was astounding. I think even those of us with an Ivy League education were struggling to keep up how a soldier with brain damage coming back from Iraq would be able to navigate that system without legal assistance is really beyond belief. And the memos show just how adversarial the system is in reality. One of the training manuals that was put up on the screen advised caseworkers who were reviewing soldier cases not to believe the, quote, exaggerations and tall tales that soldiers were telling about their wounds. Now, if you're advising the caseworkers not to believe the tall tales, that leads to a suspicion which forces the soldiers to prove their case that they were wounded in a vast and elaborate way. That means gathering evidence that you were wounded, gathering witnesses who saw, say, the rocket explode near you and you fall and bleed. For a soldier to have to come back from Iraq and do that really leads to what many of the soldiers are calling a second war, battling the VA for care after they battled the insurgents in Iraq.
You know, Joshua, one of the more interesting things that came out of that trial, and it was a lot of legal mumbo jumbo in the case because the judge is an 86-year-old Nixon appointee who doesn't want to hear from veterans in this case. He just wants to hear from lawyers. He wants to hear from quote unquote experts. And And that's what he heard from. And the VA argued that the situation is not adversarial and that the VA is there to help veterans. And this is the kind of trap that, that people are in. We're just going to take a quick listen now to Zolly Goodman. He was one of the veterans that testified last month at Winter Soldier in Maryland, which we broadcast live on Pacifica Radio. Joshua, we're going to play you his testimony of his experience coming home from the war zone, and then we'll ask for your reaction.
I was inducted into what is a processing system set up to deter people from seeking help. I was spoken to with no compassion. Every single phone call I make to the VA, I'm asked if I'm going to kill myself or somebody else in the most inhumane way you could imagine by the most inhumane people you could imagine. So after going through this process, the first thing they tried to do was medicate me. No therapy was recommended. Medications were recommended. They gave me three different medications. The first was trazodone, the second was Paxil, and the third was gabapentin, a generic form of Neuron. My doctor did not give me any information on these medications. He told me that PTSD treatment is not a science, that there is no science to it, and that you can mix and match these medications and something may work for you that doesn't work for another vet. So I left my appointment that day and I went home and I did research on the medications that I was given. And I found out that the main side effect of all three medications is suicidal thoughts and suicidal tendencies. And that's disgusting. And that man should be disgusted with himself, and every doctor that does that should be disgusted with himself. So upon deciding not to take the medication, I decided I would try therapy. So once again, I called the VA and requested therapy. I was told that I couldn't get an appointment for several months, and I cited the law again. And I was given an appointment 30 days later. So now I get to go to a 15-minute therapy session once every 30 days. And when I show up to my 15-minute therapy session, there's 15 other Vietnam vets that have the same 8 a.m. appointment that I do. And we all wait around in the lobby. Every single one of these vets is there seeking help and treatment for the same thing that I'm seeking help and treatment for. And they're all 30 years older than I am. They've been in the system 30 years longer. They've been taking the same medications for 30 years, the same therapists for 30 years. And they're still there, and they still have the same problem. So obviously, it doesn't work. There's no solution with the current situation.
Zolly Goodman, Iraq War vet, testifying last month at Winter Soldier in Maryland. Joshua Kous is with us. He is with The Nation magazine. Your response to the story that Zolly told, and also if these kind of stories are common?
It's a tragic report, and I think, Amy, you have to connect the dots about what's happening at the VA, what's happening in combat, and what's happening at the military hospitals where soldiers first turn to care. One of the startling aspects that came out in yesterday's hearing is that VA representatives treating these soldiers are given rewards for processing the soldiers quickly. And a lot of times what that means, just as that soldier reported, is a 15-minute care session in which they basically ask, how are you doing? How are things going? Are you having suicidal thoughts? Here's some meds, and then you're out the door. I heard that story over and over as I looked at dozens of cases in this past year. That kind of short-term treatment really doesn't help when you combine it with this pressure to diagnose soldiers with pre-existing conditions so the VA doesn't have to pay for care. As you know, with a case with John Town, one that was highlighted in my recent series, here was a soldier who was knocked unconscious by a rocket, went largely deaf due to the explosion, and was given the Purple Heart for those wounds. But when it came time to discharge him, the Army said that his deafness was caused by a pre-existing mental illness, personality disorder. That meant no long-term VA care, no disability pay, and of course, having to give back your signing bonus for the years that you're too wounded to serve so that Town, like thousands of these wounded Iraq vets, found out on his final day in uniform, he actually owed the Army several thousand dollars. A lot of the doctors talked about similar situations, the way they described it, being pressured by their military superiors, was this. if they're not homicidal or suicidal, find a way to get them back to Iraq. If they absolutely cannot serve, diagnose them with a pre-existing condition and get them out the door so the VA isn't burdened with treating them.
You are listening to a special Pacifica broadcast, Veterans Healthcare in Crisis. I'm Aaron Glantz, joined here by Amy Allison. Our guest on the line from the federal courthouse in San Francisco is Joshua Kors of The Nation magazine. He's on the 18th floor. On the 17th floor is the first class action lawsuit brought by Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans against the VA. Representing 1.7 million people who have now served in these two wars wearing the United States uniform. And Joshua, we just had a study released last week by the RAND Corporation, this very respected institution, that found that 300,000 veterans suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or severe depression, and 300,000 more have physical brain damage, traumatic brain injury from a roadside bomb. So the story that you're talking about, Specialist Town, is just one of many.
Absolutely. Other cases I looked at were equally shocking. I think of Sergeant Jose Rivera, who came back from Iraq with grenade shrapnel in his hands and legs. The Army said that the shrapnel was caused by personality disorder. Samantha Spitz, who fractured the pelvis.
I'm sorry, Joshua. I just want to make sure that people understand that the Army was saying that the shrapnel in her head was caused by personality disorder.
Sergeant Jose Rivera, they were saying that his wounds, which came from blasted shrapnel during his second tour in Iraq, they said that was caused by personality disorder. Samantha Spitz, who fractured her pelvis and two bones in her ankle during her service, they said that those fractures were caused by personality disorder. You link that back to the comments that were made at the beginning of this broadcast, with the VA representative saying the burden on the VA that takes so much time is proving a service connection to your wounds. How would a soldier like Samantha Spitz prove that her fractures actually came from service rather than a pre-existing mental illness? That shows just what an uphill battle these soldiers have to fight, and they're in no condition to do it because they're already brain damaged, physically wounded, or traumatized.
Joshua Kors, when you cover this particular class action lawsuit, I'm sure that you've investigated the history of bringing this kind of legal action against the Department of Veterans Affairs. What can you tell us about the history?
It's a long one, that's for sure. And as Aaron pointed out, this is hardly the last step. This case, regardless of who wins or who loses, that'll be appealed and it will climb up the ranks, potentially, to the Supreme Court. A lot of the soldiers talked about taking years to get justice in their case.
There was one decision, the Calero decision that Gordon Erspemer, the attorney, mentioned, where it took him 17 years. And in the courtroom, there were some Vietnam veterans yesterday with holding their manila envelopes, their packets of all of the paperwork they've had to go through, sometimes two or three envelopes. And I was talking to one man, maybe you met him as well, Joshua, who said that he has been appealing the same case for 23 years.
And I get cases, too. Vietnam vets who come to me with their stories, and they're pretty much the same as the cases we're seeing from Iraq and Afghanistan. Simply, the application process nowadays is 4 to 6 months, and if you feel you didn't get fair treatment, you can appeal your case. That takes about 3 years. One of the soldiers I talked to didn't even get that far. He came to the local VA after having been wounded, seeking medical care. He was told, sorry, we're full, come back in a few months. As he put it, by that time, he'll either be healed or dead. As we're seeing from the statistics in recent days, most likely the latter.
Oh, Joshua Kors, I also wanted to ask you about what specifically is being asked on the part of the plaintiffs that are bringing this lawsuit against the VA. What do they want to see happen and when?
It's a great question, and it's something that Aaron and I discussed yesterday. We don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure anybody in the courtroom does either. If the judge agrees with everything that Veterans for Common Sense has to say and agrees the system is broken and needs to be fixed, where does it go from there? What kind of fix are they going to take? Paul Sullivan, who's spearheading this case, told me that certainly there's a block of funds the VA has that it isn't spending right now on soldiers. There are potential ways to restructure the system. Perhaps if they eliminated having to prove that you were wounded in combat, that might wipe out a block of the bureaucracy and speed things along. But the question right now as to whether this bureaucracy is illegal and the delays violate due process is the central question. I think that has to be answered first before any specific concrete changes are discussed in how to alter the system.
What do you make of the Veterans Administration pointed to the fact that they've hired thousands of mental health care specialists in the last years to deal with the onslaught of cases they need to address?
Well, as a journalist reporting, it's not my job to make commentary on something like that. But I think the soldiers, as they've reported to me, are happy to see changes like that, but clearly it's not enough. It seems to me like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. When you have a system, when you have to prove you're wounded, and you have the systematic delays, adding a few thousand caseworkers will help. If they're given the same instructions as we saw up on the screen yesterday, admonishing them not to follow what soldiers say, not to take the cases at face value, to make them prove that they were wounded, and then, upon providing care, to provide 15 or 20 minutes of care because they get rewarded for dealing with so many cases, each case a new reward for the caseworker, helping them climb the bureaucratic ladder.
Well, Joshua, it was incredible. I mean, to sit in that courtroom, and it was very dry testimony. It was experts talking in acronyms for hours. But then when you stripped away those acronyms and you really thought about what it was that they were actually talking about, they were talking about specific instructions that are in the manuals that these adjudicators use, these people who decide whether or not you deserve disability compensation. They were talking about specifically that they should be skeptical, that psychiatrists who work for the VA should not believe veterans who say that I was driven crazy by war, and that these are instructions that are in the manuals, and that this was going to the heart of the case, which was that the plaintiffs, Veterans for Common Sense, at this trial are alleging that the system is broken, not just that there are a few bad apples.
And Aaron, you have to go back to Ira Katz, who wrote that devastating email which said, shh, don't reveal to CBS News and the public that 1,000 of our soldiers are killing themselves. Ira Katz is the same official who testified before Congress in July, giving a very rosy portrait of how the medical system in the military and VA is treating soldiers. It seems amongst fellow officials, he had a different opinion.
This is Pacifica Radio's national special on the crisis in veterans' health care. We're joined by Joshua Coors from The Nation magazine. He is in San Francisco just watching, witnessing, and reporting on this lawsuit that groups of Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans have levied against the Department of Veterans Affairs. We're receiving some questions from our listening audience, Joshua, at vets@kpfa.org. One of them says, well, what's the structure of the Veterans Administration? Is the VA part of armed services, or who's administering them? Is the head of the VA a cabinet-level post, and can we expect an improvement in the Veterans Affairs Department under a Democratic president in Congress?
Certainly, a journalist is not here to speculate on which party would provide better care. Remember, we're talking about systemic problems that go beyond left or right. Certainly, politicians on all sides want to see these wounded soldiers treated fairly. But with the system that's set up right now, it's not a single system, as your caller suggests. It's a broken system that's chopped up into several bits. And that's part of the problem. Amy, you'll remember with the intelligence that predated 9/11, part of the problem was that the CIA and the FBI and the other agencies all had a different piece of the puzzle. That's what we're seeing right here with the medical care within the Army and then outside with the VA. The Army might come to one conclusion about a soldier who's missing his leg. The VA might come to a radically different conclusion about the same soldier. Perhaps one of the first changes to be had here is to unify the system so that there's one diagnosis, one disability rating, and that would speed along care. Right now, soldiers have to be evaluated twice by the two separate agencies.
And can you address the question about the current structure of the Veterans Administration, since one of the possible resolutions, if the lawsuit and the judge decides that the merits of the lawsuit are worthy, is to appoint an additional head and change the decision-making structure of the VA?
It's a great question, and I'm reminded that in giving that last answer, I actually simplified the matter, if you can believe it. We have one system with the Army medical care, one system with the VA medical care, and an entirely different structure for the VA benefits system. One side will provide you with medical care, whatever that 15 minutes in drugs may be. Another side will evaluate just how disabled you are, say you lost a finger or you're coming back with blinding headaches. How much on a scale from 1 to 100 does that disable you? If you get up to 30%, you'll get long-term medical care from the VA, and your family will get long-term medical care as well. If you don't reach that 30% point, you don't get that long-term care, and neither does your family. Soldiers have to go through the two steps, getting the care from the VA and being evaluated by the board at the benefits system to see whether they pass that 30% threshold.
Well, Joshua Kors in The Nation magazine, thank you so much for checking in with us. You've been sitting in this trial on the 17th floor of the federal building in downtown San Francisco, the first class action lawsuit brought by veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan against the Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Aaron.
And we'll be right back.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain, spilled his blood in the dirt and the dust, and he's come back to say.